see is the prophet from Judah, 1 Kings 13. We looked at that chapter where the man of God out of Judah comes to the north of Bethel and prophesies against the altar of Jeroboam. And among other things, gives a long-term prophecy that Josiah will eventually burn the bones of those false prophets or priests on that altar. And then there were some short-term predictions that were fulfilled as well that authenticated the longer-term prediction. But let's go on from there then. D is Ahijah's warning, 1 Kings 14, 1-20. Yes.
Can you explain more about the prophets and suggestions?
More about which?
The prophets from the prophets, they seem like enough suggestions. Kind of irony that he was deceived that he was made by God, and the false prophet was.
All right, the question has to do with, we touched on this at the end of the last hour, last week. The question has to do with this man of God out of Judah being deceived by the old prophet, he's called, in the northern kingdom. And how do we explain what's going on there? It seems to me that the old prophet in the north was a true prophet. He was a true prophet of the Lord. He heard about what this man got out of Judah had done in confronting Jeroboam at that altar. I think he was sympathetic to what he had done. And it seems that he desired to have some fellowship with this man, this godly man from the south. He was probably isolated, didn't have much contact with other believing people there. And in order to do that, he lies. It seems to me out of self-interest. Now, of course, when he lied, he wasn't performing the function of a true prophet. That's why I'd prefer to speak of prophecy as a function rather than an office. It seems to me prophecy is when the Lord puts his word in the mouth of some individual so that the words he speaks are God's words. And but that doesn't mean every time they open their mouth that they're performing the function of a prophet. And this man, even though he had done that apparently and was known as a prophet in this particular instance, he sinned. And he did something he obviously should not have done. Now the man got out of Judah, on the other hand, had been given a direct word from the Lord that he was not to go back the same way, was not to eat bread or drink water with anyone there. And he listened to this man when he said he had a revelation. He listened to him, even though it contradicted the previous one. He should not have listened to him, because God does not contradict himself. God would not say one thing to the one person and something else to the other one. So I think both these men were at fault. Now, the man of God out of Judah that disobeyed God's word then was judged for it. As then the old prophet performs the function of a true prophet when he says, "This is what's going to happen to you. You're not going to rest with your fathers." And he was attacked and killed by the lion. So that at that point he's again performing the function of a true prophet, but when he lied to him, it was certainly a very wicked thing that he did. It was a sinful act. So you can be a true prophet yet not be a good man. The two are they usually go together. Usually a prophet is a godly person, but you can be a true prophet and a bad man. And this fellow illustrates that. Balaam was a heathen soothsayer, yet he was a true prophet. because the Lord put his words in his mouth. And he wanted to curse Israel, he couldn't. He blessed Israel. So I think cases like that are exceptions, but I think that it's important you realize the distinction that a prophet is not always a prophet in everything that he says. He can misspeak. So you perform a prophetic function, and I think that's a better way to speak of what happens when God is speaking through that person, but that's not always. You take Nathan when he went to, when he was asked by David, shall I build a temple, build a house for the Lord? And Nathan says, go ahead and do it, the Lord bless you. But you see, that was his own word. It wasn't God's word. Because then the Lord came to him that night and says, go back and tell David, you're not to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house, in the sense of a dynasty. So Nathan misspoke. He spoke when he was being asked by David to speak as a prophet. He spoke as a man. And he had to go back and correct himself when the word of the Lord came to him. Yeah.
Yeah. Question from reading that passage where Elijah, after being made fun of for being bald, the reading suggests that what he levied, the curse that he levied on those youths was justified. I was always puzzling. Does that come out from his anger, or do you agree with the interpretation given by these authors?
Well, I think something was it. I have to look and see what they said exactly. But I think something was at stake there as far as recognition. Yeah, recognition of God's word being spoken through a prophet. And if that prophet was going to be ridiculed, then it's not a personal thing, it's an office.
But they were ridiculing for being bald.
Well, yeah.
Saying anything about what he had said—that's where the puzzlement comes from.
But I think they were ridiculing him. I think they recognized that he was the successor to Elijah, and that even though they were taunting him with being bald, their disrespect went beyond just that to the function and the office. It would seem to me. Well, perhaps in that phrase. Where is that? What chapter is it? Chapter 2 of 2 Kings. 23. From there, Elisha went up to Bethel. As he was walking along the road, some youths came out of the town and jeered at him. Go on up, you bald head, they said. Go on up, you bald head. He turned around, looked at them, called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two bears came and mauled 42 of the youths. The comment I put in the NIV Study Bible is, Elisha pronounced a curse similar to the covenant curse of Leviticus 26:21-22. The result gave warning of the judgment that would come on the entire nation should it persist in disobedience and apostasy. Thus, Elisha's first acts were indicative of his ministry that would follow. God's covenant blessings would come to those who look to him. You see, that was the healing of the water there in Jericho, which was the answer to one of those questions. His first act, beginning of his ministry, was indicative of blessings that would come to those who looked to him, but God's covenant curses would fall on those who turned away from him. So it seems to me there's some symbolism involved in the relationship or attitude, you might say, of those youths towards Elijah and the attitude of the nation towards the Lord. And that in that action, it's not just a personal revenge, getting back at somebody who's taunting him. Its significance reflects his office, but it also reflects the attitudes of the nation towards the Lord, because certainly the attitude toward Elijah involved an attitude toward the Lord, since he was a prophet of the Lord. Yeah.
In the commentary,
yeah.
It says, not use the mark of death.
attached to those and really think that they were
Well, I think the text leaves that open. Yes, yes. Doesn't say they were killed, but
what does the Hebrew word "fall"?
I don't know. I don't know what it's a translation of. Yeah. I'm not sure what the Hebrew word behind that is. I could make a note of checking that out. And try to remember next week to make a comment on it. That's 2 Kings 20 or 2 Kings 2:24. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Let's get back to Ahijah's warning. 1 Kings 14. The same prophet who had told Jeroboam that he would be given the kingdom now declares that it will be taken from him. That's in verses 7 and following of chapter 14. The Lord tells Ahijah, go tell Jeroboam, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I raised you up from among the people and made you a leader over my people Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, but you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. You have done more evil than all who lived before you. You have made for yourself other gods, idols made of metal. You have provoked me to anger and thrust me behind your back. Because of this, I'm going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it is all gone. Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. The Lord has spoken. So that message of judgment is given to Jeroboam by Ahijah. The setting, as you remember, is Jeroboam's inquiry to Ahijah about his sick son. He sends his wife in disguise, and he doesn't fool Ahijah by that, but he's told that the son will die. And you find that in verse 12, where he says, as for you, you go back home. When you set foot in your city, the boy will die. I think it's interesting that you get a reflection of what has often been termed the covenant lawsuit. Covenant lawsuit. I think you get a reflection of that covenant lawsuit in the judgment that Ahijah pronounces. You notice in verse 7 and 8a, Ahijah recites the gracious acts of the Lord. I raised you up from among the people and made you a leader over my people Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you. So those of you who are familiar with that analogy between the Hittite treaties and the biblical covenant material, the Hittite treaties begin with that historical prologue, and so does the biblical covenant material. The historical prologue with the biblical covenant material is the gracious acts of the Lord. I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, do this and this and this. So that when Israel turns away from the covenant and a prophet is sent to call Israel back to the covenant, you'll often find in the prophetic books, now this isn't in a prophetic book, but it's a prophet speaking, that the prophets will use sort of a form that reflects that covenant form and first recite the gracious acts of the Lord. Here's what I've done, but here's what you've done. I've been faithful and gracious, but you've turned away and been disobedient, and then pronounce a sentence. So you see here in 7 and 8a, you have the gracious acts of the Lord, and in 8b and 9, you have the indictment, but you have not been like my servant David. You have done more evil than all lived before you. You have made for yourselves other gods. And then the third element, the sentence, which you have in verse 10 and following. Because of this, here's what I'm going to do. So, I think you get some reflection of that in the form of the message there that Ahijah brings. All right, that was D, Ahijah's warning to Jeroboam. E on your sheet is Nadab's reign. Fifteen twenty-five through 28. In chapter 14, you switch back to Judah there with Rehoboam, and into the early part of chapter 15. But then at 15:25, you read, Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. He reigned over Israel 2 years. Nadab only reigned 2 years. You only have these four verses that speak of him, 25 through 28. He's really not an important king. And he's killed in what you might call a palace revolt. Because you read in 27, Baasha, son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, plotted against him, struck him down at Gibbethon, a Philistine town, while Nadab and all Israel were besieging it. Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and succeeded him as king. So that brings us to 2, the dynasty of Baasha. And I have several subpoints there. A is his accession. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this dynasty of Baasha, but his accession is 1 Kings 15:27 to 30, and then down in 33 and 34. As we already noted, Baasha killed Nadab, who was Jeroboam's son. And then he killed all the house of Jeroboam, fulfilling then the prediction of Ahijah, that Jeroboam's house would be wiped out. So you read in verse 20, he did not leave Jeroboam anyone to breathe, destroyed them all, according to the word of the Lord through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite, because of the sins of Jeroboam. All right, B is his wars against Judah, 15:32. You just have that brief statement. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. Now, we read more of that when you read about the rule of Asa in the south. Baasha fought with Asa of the south. The occasion for that hostility was the attempt to prevent northerners from going south to worship. Jeroboam built the altars there. He was concerned about that. And as Baasha comes on the throne, he's still concerned about it. And as we discussed last week, when Baasha attacks the south and Asa, that provokes Asa to make an alliance with Ben-Hadad of Damascus in Syria. So, and then Baasha was forced to stop that pressure he had been putting on the south. All right, so those are his wars against Judah. C, Jehu's prophecy, 16:1-7. Now the Jehu here is termed Jehu, son of Hanani. It's not the same Jehu who later was a king. But this Jehu was a prophet. And he told Baasha that his house would be destroyed just like that of Jeroboam. You read in verse 3, the Lord says through Jehu, I am about to consume Baasha and his house. I will make your house like that of Jeroboam. Dogs will eat those belonging to Baasha who die in the city. The birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. D is Elah's reign. 1 Kings 16, verse 8 and following. he was the son of Baasha. And again, not an important king. He only reigned 2 years. You read at the end of verse 8, Elah, son of Baasha, became king in Israel. He reigned in Tirzah 2 years. And then you get another revolution, which is Zimri's usurpation, 1 Kings 16:9 through 13. Zimri, one of his officials, plotted against him. And you read in 10, Zimri came in, struck him down, killed him, and succeeded him as king. So Zimri was one of Baasha's officials. He plots against Baasha. He kills him. And then he does the same thing Baasha had done. He kills all the house of Baasha. And you read that in verse 11. He killed off Baasha's whole family. Didn't spare a single male, whether relative or friend. Now, Zimri's reign, however, was very short-lived. He reigned for 7 days. You read that in verse 15. Zimri reigned in Tirzah 7 days. And then he killed himself. You read in verse 18, when Omri marches marches against Tirzah, where Zimri was. You read in verse 17, Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon, laid siege to Tirzah. When Zimri saw the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace, set the palace on fire around him, so he died because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking the ways of Jeroboam, and so forth. And then F on your sheet is interregnum, 4 years. It seems that after the death of Zimri, it seems like there was a time of struggle between Omri and Tibni for the kingship. And it seems like it was 4 years before Omri finally wins out and consolidates his power sufficiently to be proclaimed king and rule. And the reason I say that is if you look at 1 Kings 16:15, you read there, in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, Zimri reigned in Tirzah 7 days. And then Zimri kills himself. But you compare that with 16:23, where Omri becomes king, and you read in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel. He reigned 12 years, six of them in Tirzah. That's verse 23. So that's the 31st year compared to the 27th year. So it seems like there's a 4 year period there where there's struggle between Omri and Tibni. See, you read in verse 21, the people of Israel were split into two factions, half supported Tibni for king. The other half supported Omri. But Omri's followers proved stronger than those of Tibni. So Tibni died, Omri became king, and he really officially begins to reign in the 31st year. So it looks like there's quite a lengthy period of instability and uncertainty about who was really going to win out and become king. Okay, that brings us down to D. That was the first two dynasties of Israel. D is the dynasty of Omri. And one under D is Omri himself, 1 Kings 16:15 to 28. I have three subpoints there. First is accession, 1 Kings 16:21 and 22. We've already looked at that. You read in 21 and 22 about that struggle between Omri and Tibni. And then, actually, in verse 23, you read that he becomes king. You read he reigned 12 years, six of them in Tirzah, which means he reigned 6 years also in Samaria. B on your sheet is his new capital. You read in verse 24, he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria, after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. Omri's an important ruler. He selects this site, which was a strategically located site. It was well chosen, located on a hill, easy to defend, centrally located in the territory of the Northern Kingdom. And he establishes there a new capital city. And Samaria remained the capital then of the Northern Kingdom from that point until the time of the captivity in 721. And it quickly became even larger than Jerusalem to be the most important city in Palestine. When the Assyrians finally came and attacked the Northern Kingdom, Samaria was able to hold out for 3 years. They laid siege to that city. It was a difficult city to take, and they were able to resist until eventually they had to surrender. But Omri sets up a new capital. C is his statesmanship. This is on your outline. There's not a lot said about that, but apparently he made friendship with Judah. We don't read of wars between the northern and the southern kingdom during the time of Omri. There's no reference to conflict there. It seems that he concluded alliances with some of the surrounding nations. And that's clear in the case of the Phoenicians, because his son Ahab married Jezebel, who was the daughter of the king of Tyre. Pardon? His son Ahab. Son Ahab. Married Jezebel. You read of that in verse 31. Under the comments on Ahab, where it says that he married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. But undoubtedly that was a marriage alliance concluded between Omri and Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. All right, D is his importance. There's not much said about him in 1 Kings. You only have verses 23 to 28. Six verses. But the interesting thing is, in Assyrian records, Israel is referred to as the land of Omri as late as 733 by Tiglath-Pileser III. So that's 733. That's 150 years later. Omri would be about 800. About 880. Omri would be about 880. 733, Tiglath-Pileser III, referring to Israel, speaks of it as the land of Omri. Shalmaneser III calls Jehu the son of Omri. Jehu kneeling before the Assyrian ruler, giving the tribute. But Shalmaneser calls Jehu the son of Omri, which is interesting, because he really wasn't the son of Omri. Jehu was the one that wiped out Omri's dynasty, or Ahab's line. But you see, the name was important to the Assyrians, not knowing all the details of the royal lines in Israel. He's just known as the son of Omri because he was on the throne in Samaria. Yeah. Omri's date is 880, approximately. So 841 would be about 40 years later. And then also King Mesha of Moab on the Moabite stone says that Omri, king of Israel, humbled Moab many years and occupied the land of Medeba. Omri, king of Israel, humbled Moab many years and occupied the land of Medeba. Medeba is an area to the east of Jericho on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So, from some of these extra-biblical references, you get the idea that Omri is a rather significant figure, even though the biblical text does not say much about him. Now, I said something about that earlier in this course. I think the reason why the biblical text doesn't dwell on Omri is it's not the purpose of the writer of 1st and 2nd Kings to dwell on political, economic factors. It's the covenantal issues, the issues of Israel's faithfulness to the Lord that are of utmost importance to the writer. And so instead of dwelling on Omri, he dwells on Ahab, Omri's son, who introduced Baal worship through his marriage with Jezebel. And you get a number of chapters devoted to Ahab, much more than you do to Omri. I think we can say that the relation of Ahab to Omri is similar to that of Solomon to David. In this sense, each inherited a kingdom that his father had established. Solomon came on the scene after David had really built the kingdom, you might say. And Ahab comes on the scene after Omri has established an important kingdom in the north of Israel. Each inherited the kingdom his father had established. All right, that brings us to Ahab, which is number two on your sheet. 1 Kings 16:28 to 22:40. Quite a few chapters there devoted to Ahab. You notice I have quite a few sub-points here too. The ministry of Elijah and Elisha, to a large part, fits into the time of Ahab. Now, Elisha goes beyond that into the time of Ahab's sons. But let's look first at his person. 1 Kings 16:29-34. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel. He reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. But he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worshipped him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua the son of Nun. So as far as his person is concerned, he's pictured as doing more evil than any king before him. He not only continued the calf worship of Jeroboam, that almost becomes a trivial thing. He goes much further than that and institutes Baal worship. So clearly he violates not only the second commandment, but also the first. He serves other gods. And you have that list of things that he did, which ends with a reference to the refortification of Jericho, verse 34. Jericho had remained what's called an open city since the time of the conquest. Remember when the Israelites came into Canaan, the Lord gave Jericho into their hands as they marched around the city, and the walls fell down. They were destroyed at the hands of the Lord. And Joshua at that time pronounced a curse on anyone who would refortify Jericho. Now, I think there's some significance in that. You can ask the question, why was Jericho to remain an open city? It seems to me that God's intent there is that those ruined walls were to be a testimony or a symbol to all succeeding generations that Israel had received the land from the hand of the Lord as a gift of His grace. It wasn't their military strategy, their military might that acquired the land of Canaan for them. The Lord gave it to them. And those ruins were to be a monument to the fact that they had received the land from God's hand as a gift of His grace. So it was to remain an open city. As testimony to the fact that Israel's security did not lie in military fortifications. Their security rested elsewhere. It was in obedience to the Lord. And the Lord promised that if they were obedient, He would protect them. But now you get a king on the throne in the north who isn't a true covenantal king. And he looks at that city with its ruined walls, and in his judgment, that's a liability rather than a strength. It's a liability rather than a symbol of promise. So you read that in Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilds Jericho. And I think that's to be understood as refortifies, it rebuilds the walls. It speaks of laying the foundations and setting up its gates. But he does that at the cost of his two sons, according to the curse of Joshua. That goes back to Joshua 6:26. Chapter 6 of Joshua tells about the taking of Jericho, and Joshua says in verse 26, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son will he lay its foundations, at the cost of his youngest will he set up his gates." And you think, all through that time, through time of the judges, through time of Saul, through time of David, through time of Solomon, even with all the great building activity of Solomon, Jericho remained an open city. Well, it depends on how you set the time of the conquest, but if you put it at 1446, you're down now into the 800s. It's 500-600 years. So it's a long time. It remained an unfortified city. But now Ahab doesn't like that. And I think that reflects the attitude of Ahab. He's trusting in not in the Lord, but in his own military strategies and fortifications and armies and so forth. Okay, B is his wife. 1 Kings 16:31. Hmm. He married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. Tyre and Sidon were prosperous sea trading cities on the coast of Phoenicia. The marriage was probably arranged in connection with an alliance between Ethbaal and Omri, Ahab's father. And as we read in subsequent narratives, Jezebel turns out to be a very strong-willed and ruthless woman. She probably came to Israel thinking that these people are backward people, uncultured people, compared with Tyre and Sidon. Thought their religion was unacceptable, so she establishes Baal worship and maintains a core of 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the goddess Asherah. You read that in 1 Kings 18, 19. Summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel. Bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So she provided for these 850 heathen prophets, which she imported into the northern kingdom. She also shows that her idea of kingship is completely contrary to the biblical or covenantal idea of kingship in the matter of Naboth's vineyard. Remember, Ahab was displeased because he couldn't persuade Naboth to sell him his vineyard, and Jezebel enters into that and abuses the judicial system, arranges for false witnesses to testify against Naboth so that he is stoned, and then she takes the property and gives it to Ahab. It's that incident, of course, Ahab has some complicity in that. He went along with it. And it's that incident that leads to Elijah's prophecy of judgment on Ahab's house. But Jezebel certainly is a prominent figure in the northern kingdom this time and had an active role in the introduction of heathen worship into the northern kingdom. And that comes to see then the menace of Baal worship. 1 Kings 16, 32 and 33. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. He made an Asherah pole. Did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. When Jeroboam had established the golden calves, we talked about that before, it seems like he was still, although violating the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, he was still attempting to worship the Lord through an improper means, but it was still the Lord. When he did that, that man of God out of Judah rebuked him for it. And Baasha, as he continued that calf worship, was rebuked by Jehu, son of Hanani. But now you have a new thing. It's not just the golden calves. Now it's Baal worship. And as that is introduced by Ahab, the Lord opposes it by sending Elijah and Elisha. So here, sort of in the heart of the book of Kings, at the end of 1 Kings and overlapping into the first part of 2 Kings, you have a great deal of material given over to the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. I think Baal worship represented the greatest crisis in the religious life of Israel from the time of the entrance into Canaan until the time of Christ. And as you reflect on that, this is a serious crisis for Israel. Is true faith going to remain among God's people? So that there's a great deal of attention given to the ministries of Elijah and Elisha as they confront that issue. And the interesting thing is, you also have here one of the great periods of miracles and signs. One of the greatest periods to be found anywhere in the Bible. It seems that signs and wonders usually accompany great turning points in the history of redemption. And if you reflect on that a minute, you have them, I think it's basically four periods in biblical history. You have them at the time of the Exodus and conquest. You have them here in the time of Elijah and Elisha. And then you get them during the time of the life of Christ. And also in the early days of the church. Great turning points in the history of redemption. And you then get sort of a profusion of miracles at those critical periods of redemptive history. Okay. 8 o'clock already. What I want to do here is stop our discussion of Ahab for a bit and turn to a discussion of something I've said I'm going to discuss, and that is, how do we get at the meaning of these narratives for today? In other words, how do you preach on historical narratives of the Old Testament? Let's take a 10-minute break. When we come back, I want to address that issue somewhat in a more theoretical way initially, and probably that's about all we'll get done tonight. But then carrying on, looking at some of these narratives of Elijah's ministry, which is where we move, and try to illustrate from some of those passages what we talk about in a more theoretical way, how we get at meaning of these narratives. So let's take a 10-minute break and come back and we'll move into that.